Hello and a very sunny bienvenue to the Film Weekly Cannes Film Festival special with me, Jason Solomons. I'm on the balcony of the press club here at the Palais des Festivals. A traditional Cannes scene is to my right, a starlet and her director pose for the cameras. Yachts busy themselves in the blue harbour while the Croisette stretches on down a mile of golden sand to my left. It is a wonderful setting for our second Film Weekly special here from the 62nd Cannes Film Festival. And it's definitely the first time I'm going to say this. On Film Weekly, this week's guests are Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola. Yes, you heard it right. Marty and Francis, to you and me. I'll be talking to Martin Scorsese about his passion for British cinema, his presentation here at Cannes of a beautifully restored print of Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes, and of course, his history in Cannes. Zan Brooks met up with the mighty Francis Ford Coppola to find out why at 70 years old he's going back to basics with his new film Tetro. And Zan will be joining me to run down some of the highlights of the Cannes competition. I'll be joined also by French critic and curator Agnès Parrier. I'll also be hearing from a director who's carrying the Scorsese flame here in Europe, the brilliant Jacques Audiard, hotly tipped to take a prize here for his compelling film, Un Prophète. More of him to come. Stay tuned, it's Film Weekly from France. First up, and rightly so, on the Film Weekly red-carpeted steps, it's the man with the red shoes. Yes, Martin Scorsese, who's brought Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger back to sparkling life on the Croisette with a restored print of their 1948 classic, The Red Shoes. Scorsese, of course, had a very direct connection to Michael Powell. His long-standing editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, married Powell in the early 80s, but his debt to Powell and the broader history of British cinema has been paid in part with this revival of The Red Shoes. I met up with Martin Scorsese to probe further into his relationship with British film, but first, let's hear a clip of that classic, The Red Shoes.
I'm afraid this is going to be your fate for the next 2 weeks. Mr. Krauss is going to play The Red Shoes music for you at every lunch, tea, and dinner you take until you open.
I see.
Yes. In this way, you should become quite familiar with the music.
Yes, I think I probably shall.
The music is all that matters. Nothing but the music. Huh? Mr. Krasner?
Certainly.
What are we doing?
Martin Scorsese, a great pleasure to see you. Congratulations on restoring the Red Shoes and presenting it here at Cannes. It must have been some kind of thrill. You looked delighted when I saw you on the stage opening it in front of such an audience. It was almost as if they were seeing magic for the first time.
Well, yeah. In fact, I always tell Thelma I envy the audience that that's experiencing the film for the very first time. I really do. I saw the picture when I was 8 years old. Of course, it stayed with me for my life and made a major difference in my life. And that's one of the reasons, along with the other Powell Pressburger pictures and Peeping Tom that Michael Powell directed on his own and The Edge of the World. These are the films that meant so much to us and encouraged us and nourished that generation. And by the way, that generation is being De Palma, Spielberg, Schrader.
Mr. Coppola.
Coppola, yes. So that... What happened is that we were all in different parts of the world. We didn't know each other and called each other up and said, come and see this movie. We suddenly, as we were talking in Los Angeles, at many of the dinners we would have and lunches or whatever, or meetings and hanging out, so to speak, someone would talk about a scene they just saw of a film on television. They said, you like that too? Yeah, well, you have to see the whole picture. But I heard it was in color. It's shown in black and white, and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so the famous one everyone knew was The Red Shoes. Yeah. But that opened up a whole treasure trove of pictures coming out of the Powell Pressburger unit.
It's odd to see that you here together, and Francis Ford Coppola is here with presenting a new film,
yes, right,
of his Tetra, in which he makes explicit reference and quotes from The Tales of Hoffman,
right,
and The Red Shoes.
That's right.
Did you two sit down? I know you don't. Did you sit down and sort of say, oh, well, let's go with our both Powell homages together?
No, not at all. But he's been doing that since One from the Heart, right? He did the homage to Thief of Baghdad in that, The All-Seeing Eye. And, of course, when I actually got to meet Michael Powell back in 1975, I think, and Michael Kaplan, who was working with Stanley Kubrick at the time, he introduced me to him. Because we didn't really, there was hardly anything written about them. I think they had really, in a sense, fallen out of fashion, I think. But you see, in America, particularly amongst younger people who were interested in film or just liked movies, the English cinema, the British cinema, there was one and the same. In other words, we didn't see a difference in the different periods. Yes, we knew the war, the wartime. We know that what happened with England during the war, and those films in which we serve, and Went the Day Well, Millions Like Us, This Happy Breed. Mm-hmm. We understood Vacation for Marriage. We understood all these things, but we saw them all at once.
Right.
We did not see them in context.
I think we Brits have an inferiority complex when it comes to cinema.
You should not have. I mean, I adore. We have so many people that I know really, really, really learned so much from British cinema, let alone not only just the nature of the nature of a depiction of a culture and people, but also editing. The way a film is edited.
The craft, you mean?
The craft, absolutely. We're discovering. Kevin Brownlow, I think, did a beautiful documentary on the silent cinema, and they showed the section on the British cinema at the time, and I think it was Kevin Branagh doing the voiceover. But they showed clips of this fascinating silent film called The Cottage in Dartmoor.
I should know
you
that.
You have to see this.
In Dartmoor?
Yeah. Anthony Asquith inventing a very different cinematic language with film editing and camera positions, different from Russian montage and German from the 1920s, uniquely British. And this is a find, that's a revelation, that picture. And to us it is, anyway. The past 4 or 5 years we've been looking at it all the time.
Yeah.
A Cottage of Dartmoor. Take a look at that.
So, let's just talk about British cinema briefly before we move on to the world. It's a good starting point. In fact, we invented the world anyway.
You found it.
We lost it since, but that's fine.
it wasn't what it cracked up to me.
No, you know, we just went around the world. Nice place.
Wouldn't want to live there.
I'm here all week. It's fine.
Why change points?
What characterizes British cinema for you? Because I know you're going to do this long gestating British documentary. The first time I met you, which is 12 years ago, you said you would do it.
We hope by the end of the year to come up with a rough cut of it. We've done so far. Again, we're approaching the British cinema through my first exposure to it, which was on television with the Quarter Pictures. And also some Quarter Quickies that were shown on television. Mm-hmm. And we've done Rembrandt so far, Things to Come, Thief of Baghdad, Four Feathers, Drum, and all of these things.
You like The Magic Box, I remember.
The Magic Box was the one where I learned about the persistence of vision?
Yeah,
the whole concept of how an image moves, supposedly. And that's where the documentary starts again. And so for me, there's a kind of... interesting, being Italian American, or more being raised more by Sicilians, really, and seeing a kind of an emotional state that everyone was constantly in. Just even if they open a window to look out to see the weather, it becomes very emotional. What happens then in the English cinema, what we all enjoyed was a kind of restraint, and yet, and the restraint was also in the camera. Not necessarily in A Cottage of Dartmoor. That's something else. It's silent film technique. But in the sound films, the restraint in camera, the restraint in behavior, yet with very, very powerful emotional content, great conflict.
These are cineasts like David... Do you mean David Lean?
David Lean, certainly, in the early Hitchcock films. And, of course, Michael Powell, The Edge of the World... which has got, I think, more Powell's stuff is more, since I think he was raised, and it's very unusual because he was raised in the south of France, I think, and it may be another influence along finally with Emmerich Pressburger.
Yeah, that's a different, another
classic,
shade coming in.
The classic is, of course, Kind Hearts and Coronets, which we saw on a small little TV screen, 16-inch TV or 12-inch, whatever it was, and the restraint and the humor, the deadpan humor, of the voiceover narration. This is really, literally, was formative to the point where I had to use narration pretty much every movie I've ever done.
So Henry Hill is directly influenced by Gascoigne Dascoigne.
Absolutely. He's got the same aspirations. I mean, only he winds, the height of his aspirations is the Copacabana.
Yes.
He gets there for a moment.
That's true. I wonder where you stand, Martin, on
my little daughter now has become a great admirer of Alastair Sim. She's 9 years old, and she saw him in A Christmas Carol, and she just thought it was fantastic.
One of the finest films ever made.
Then we showed her The Ladykillers, and she kept mentioning the main character, as one word, is Alec Guinness. Alec Guinness, she kept saying. Alec and Herbert Lahm, and just one of the best singers. These are, by the way, shown in 35mm. Mm-hmm. So that she's about 9 years old now. But she could see the difference. She sees the difference in the behavior and the humor. We're about to screen The Bells of St. Trinian.
Show the old St. Trinian, not the new ones.
not the new ones.
Marty, what about the freer approaches that came into British cinema? I suppose that I would always think were more akin to your work, the kind of free cinema of Schlesinger and Rice, and even now Ken Loach.
Well, Ken Loach is a great artist, and what he does, it's just extraordinary. But going back to Kes, right? I mean, yes, really.
It's 40 years ago this week. It was in Cannes.
Really?
Yeah.
40 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, he's a great artist, and it comes from something inside, and he just creates that film with his actors, and it's just a remarkable work. And yet, we were very, very excited by... The new British cinema, the free cinema of Lindsay Anderson, Tony, Carol Rice, and Tony Richardson, Seth Holt, also John Schlesinger, you know, Darling, A Kind of Loving, but primarily Lindsay Anderson's The Sporting Life and Oh Lucky Man, yeah. Which is again a redefinition, kind of a redefining of narrative, which kind of I think in a way is almost based in the 18th century. Pilgrim's Progress. Yeah, John Bunyan. So, had a century wrong there, but pretty close. I was close. But that was a key. Tony Richardson's Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, and even Tom Jones has some wonderful sequences. And Carol Rice's film, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, is a very important film. The moment that Albert Finney looks in the mirror and says, "What am I?" That was a key direct reference in Mean Streets. To the beginning of the film where Harvey gets up, looks in the mirror, and then puts his head back on the pillow, and Be My Baby kicks in. Mm-hmm. I just had that, it was so strong. He's such a wonderful actor. And it's near the end of the film. I just saw it recently again about 3 weeks ago.
Most British men of a certain age wanted to be Albert Finney at that moment. And I think there's a lot of people, most about. American men of a certain age wanted to be Harvey at that moment.
Yeah, well, I felt it with through Finney. Yeah. But you see, the thing at that time, it's like any other new movement, I guess, new cinema comes in and wipes away the old. But we saw it all together. So we had no sense, we in no way really said, well, this is out of fashion. Kind Hearts and Coronets is out of fashion. The Red Shoes is out of fashion. No, we saw British cinema all as one. Mm-hmm. And this was a kind of advantage.
Why is it important? We'll start with British. Why is it important for you to kind of know cinema history so much? Why do you think it's important for in your work it comes out, but for a younger generation, which you're now doing with the restorations that you're doing with the World Cinema Foundation? Why is history so important in a visual sense?
Well, don't you think it has to do with enriching the new work? Mm. Exciting. One of the best professions, I think, is to be a teacher, because you really learn so much from the students. And the students, you to see younger people excited by something. Some may achieve a certain level in their work. Some may not. But to see them try and to see them be influenced and excited by other work is remarkable. And it reinvigorates me in a way.
Right. And what about, where does Cannes stand in your career? Here we are in Cannes, in the Carlton Hotel. I mean, it's a great place to launch World Cinema Foundation.
Yes, because this was 2 years ago.
Right. I mean, and things have come, many of those films screened first in Cannes, and perhaps were never seen again.
I know.
What does Cannes mean to you?
Well, Cannes really is the centerpiece of the World Festival circuit in a way, and it's the best place. Everyone's here. It's the best place to get the message out, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a great starting point.
Yeah. What's your personal relationship with it over the years?
Mean Streets was one of the best times I've ever had coming here. It was shown at the Critics Week.
Kansan,
yeah. And Taxi Driver was here, but we only stayed 2 days then. Went back. And over the years, it's really been a place that's welcomed me, King of Comedy was the opening night of the new Palais. After Hours was received very well here. And so it's a place that we keep coming back to. And it has the excitement. It has what is new, what is happening around the world. And it's the place from which everything else is launched.
Yeah.
But when you, it's true, though. You say that many of the films have been shown in Cannes over the years will never be seen again. So we're trying to rectify that, you see.
And I wish you the best of luck. Yeah. Oftentimes in Cannes, you know, you get, it's great about the films, but then you get the late nights, and then you wander around the Croisette or the Rue d'Antibes, slightly drunk. I have Griffin Dunne moments often in Cannes.
I know. Yeah. No, the same, and also it's the jet lag for me, too.
Yes.
You really don't know what the heck is going on.
Guys, I wish you the best of luck with the Red Shoes. It's going to Edinburgh Film Festival,
yes.
So we'll see it there and then on DVD.
Yes.
So, Martin Scorsese,
good
to see you.
Okay.
This year's festival, the 62nd, with its power cuts, striking city workers and credit crunch, of course, has thrown up the usual rich array of films from filmmakers around the world. To help me sift some of the movie gold from the pan of Cannes, I'm joined by Guardian critic at large, Zan Brooks, and French writer and programmer, Agnès Poirier. Welcome to Film Weekly, both of you. Zan, we'll be finding a bit more about your interview with Francis Ford Coppola in a minute, but your overall feeling of the festival, a good one, a vintage one, or a mediocre one?
Well, I think the general feeling is that it's been a mediocre one, but I would disagree. I think it's been a very good one. Obviously, it's been played out under the great kind of storm clouds of recession, and, you know, attendance and business is something like 30% down, whereas the films seem to be about 30% longer. We've seen a lot of very, very long films, so Cannes kind of giveth with one hand and taketh with the other. But generally, I think that the quality has been very good. The weather's been great. The films, by and large, have been great. So I think it's been a good year.
And Agnès, how has France viewed Cannes? Is their home film festival, has it been a success on the global stage?
I think it's the world's festival. It's not France's festival. Frankly, this is a very good vintage. And I haven't heard anywhere that it was a mediocre year, actually. Perhaps for the buyers and the sellers, obviously.
Well, here we are as critics on our Mount Olympus. Let's talk about the man who described this week Cannes as a Mount Olympus, Quentin Tarantino, whose very presence in Cannes is always feted like a returning hero. He's been president of the jury, he's won the Palme d'Or for Pulp Fiction. He was in competition with Inglourious Basterds. And yes, les Français adorent Quentin Tarantino.
Well, we all do, don't we? And actually, I've never been a great fan of his, but I think this is his masterpiece. And I know this film is very divisive. I know a lot of people find it too long. Some actually hate it, but I think it's a sort of elegy to cinema, which is wonderful because it's a film within the film, and it's also the rewriting of history. I mean, imagine what you can do with cinema, what a euphoric offer. And I've never been offered such a, you know, fantastic proposition, is that cinema can rewrite history, can remake history.
So, Agnès likes it. She said it was divisive. I think we have here, on my other hand, someone who hates it. Zan.
Yeah, I'm going to divide here. Divide and hopefully rule, but maybe not. I was sort of perplexed by it. I didn't hate it. I was perplexed by it and finally irritated by it. I understand what Agnès is saying, that I like the fact that it dared to rewrite history and dared to kind of push those boundaries. And I admired its audacity, but it was a weird mixture of being very audacious and incredibly timid and flabby and indulgent, and all the cinematic references, some of which worked. I like the fact that Michael Fassbender plays a sort of heroic film critic. I mean, obviously we all like that, even though he turns out to be not so heroic in the end. But a lot of the other references I felt were almost kind of special pleading to the jury. Of course, France always has respected the director and all these things. And you think, who are you pitching this at? You know, you're playing in Cannes, that's fine. But let's keep it within certain boundaries here. I thought this was a misfire from Tarantino. And if he was, you know, if this is the Mount Olympus, then I think he fell off it with this one.
Well, it's less of a misfire than his last, I think, Death Proof. But I don't think it's as good as Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction. However, I'm kind of convinced I'm somewhere in between both of you, because I really enjoyed watching it. Came out thinking, well, that's mad, it's kind of also bad, it's kind of cool, which is what Tarantino peddles in. But I also thought it was rather silly as well, in that if you are going to rewrite history, you have some kind of responsibility as a cineast here. With great art comes great responsibility, and I just think he's kind of throwing all that intelligence slight away, really, and kind of saying that the Jews kind of have used cinema to avenge themselves on the whole pack of you.
I don't think it's a revenge not only of the Jews, but of cinema. I don't know. I mean, it's a lesson in not only in cinema and the history of cinema, but in freedom.
Now, another person who kind of has that maverick enfant terrible rather than enfant gâté, enfant terrible rather than spoilt child, is Lars von Trier, who has come equally divisively with his film Antichrist, which Zan, who also went to meet Charlotte Gainsbourg, who I suppose holds one of the great images of Cannes in a scene of unforgettable genital mutilation. Antichrist, Zan, I can't even begin to think about it.
Well, I think you have to think about it. I think it's a film that makes you think about it. I would say there are films here that I've enjoyed more, certainly, and that I would say are stronger films in competition than Antichrist in the final analysis. And yet, Antichrist is the film that stayed with me and has kind of haunted me and has actually kept me awake at night after the screening thinking about it. It's not a pleasant film. It's not an easy film. But this is kind of what you get when you get the director's can. If this is what they're saying it is, the director's can, then you're going to get these kind of uncompromising, sometimes unpleasant, inquiries into the director's subconscious. And this tells us probably a lot that we maybe even don't want to know about Lars von Trier. You know, it's all about his terrors. It's about his terrors of nature, of where we come from, his terrors particularly of female sexuality and maybe women in general. And it's not pretty, but it is utterly compelling.
And yes, has Zan sold Antichrist to you?
No, and I actually refused to see the film. I thought about it for 10 minutes and I thought, no. I mean, he usually gives me the biggest headaches. And the guy's a manipulator. I mean, I'm not even sure he's talented, actually. And, you know, misogyny is quite rife. I mean, you don't need a film on woman is evil. We've got, you know, we get that on a daily basis. And I don't necessarily want to see it, you know, in big, on a big screen in my face for, what, 2 hours and 30 minutes?
Let's move on to what I think is one of the most stunning contributions to the competition. I would be quite surprised if it doesn't get a prize on Sunday. This is Michael Haneke's Das Weiße Band, The White Ribbon, an austere, sincere, long, black and white look at a rural village in Germany in 1910. I thought this was a quite beautiful, breathtaking masterpiece of a movie that was a real sobering counterpart to the wild and whirling, infantile nature of Tarantino's Ode to Cinema. And yes, did it stun you?
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, it's a hypnotic film. And he's doing... I mean, a lot of his films before have had this sort of uneasiness and unpleasantness. Mm. Just think of Funny Games, obviously, but also some other films before Caché. He gets the tone so well, and the time as well. 1910s rural Germany, and he's born in 45, I think. And you know, the people, the way people relate to each other, the way people talk and actually walk, for instance, he gets that perfectly. It's beautiful. The framing is stunning. It's 2 hours and 30 minutes, but you wish it was going on for another six. It's Bergman, but with a plot.
It is. I mean, I just found it was a bit like being sat down and told off for 2.5 hours, but I came out thoroughly reprimanded and I'll never do it again. Zan?
Well, yes, I think what he's doing here is a very subtle political allegory, isn't it? I mean, this is set in the run-up to the First World War, but it's actually kind of foreshadowing the Second World War, where you've got these kind of midwitch cuckoo-style children who are all very beautiful and clean-limbed and look idyllic. But there's this sense that sort of Germany is incubating monsters and that these little children are going to grow up to be, you know, the outriders for the Third Reich. And that is, I think, at the heart of this film. I admired this to hell. I thought this was beautiful to look at, absolutely perfectly paced and measured, and all the little details are quite right. The only thing that I would say about it, which is picking up on your point about being lectured at, I do find Haneke quite a kind of cold, aloof director. So while I can kind of admire his films, and probably this is a masterpiece, they're still hard to warm to.
God, I mean, they're incredibly hard work, but the length and the austerity of it. I thought, I mean, it reminded me of Hidden, as you mentioned, Caché there. It reminded me of Hidden, which is a very modern-day parable, but this was sort of set back, you know, 90 years before Hidden. I mean, I was sort of, you know, spellbound by it. I kind of bow before the images and the beauty of the craft. As Zan said, it's a director's festival. The great auteurs of the world were assembled here. One of them, Pedro Almodovar, a Cannes favourite. He was back here with Broken Embraces, starring again Penelope Cruz as a starlet trapped in a marriage to a rich industrialist, but falling in love with a blind filmmaker. And yes, are you an Almodovar fan anyway?
I'm not an early Almodovar fan. I am a fan of his last four films, the ones that he did before, Broken Embraces. And it's a mystery to a lot of people why he didn't get the Palme d'Or for either La Mala Education or for Talk to Her. But I don't think he's going to get anything with this one, which I thought was flat, boring. I mean, Penelope Cruz is wonderful, but isn't she always wonderful? And this film, within this film, doesn't work at all. And yeah, it's just boring.
Yes, it was. It was very strangely flat. I mean, it looks like an Almodovar film. It feels like an Almodovar film, but it just wasn't really an Almodovar film. It was him trying to be someone else, I thought. I mean, good luck to him for trying something different after a run of five or four films, as Anya says, which I think are all extraordinary. This one, it's sort of quite a large falling off for me.
Well, I think it's a falling down the rabbit hole of cinema, isn't it? I mean, there's been a lot of films about films here this year, and I think that this is his homage to cinema and to film noir, and there's lots of sort of cinematic references all through it. I enjoyed this at the time, I have to say. It completely sort of won me over. I thought it was rich, I thought it was ravishing, I thought it was beautiful to look at. And then as soon as I stepped out of the cinema, it was gone. And it left no trace at all. So, you know, in the end, I'm having to kind of quickly reappraise my opinion of it. In the middle of it, I was thinking this is working for me entirely, but it's finally very insubstantial.
It is interesting that you say that it's kind of gone, because I think the films that stay with you in Cannes are the ones that you say haunt your nightmares, or the ones that you wander around the Croisette with the images still tumbling around your head. So we've gone through some of the major highlights there. And yes, what films have actually stayed with you? What little gems have you picked up as you've been sifting around Cannes?
Well, I have to go back to the Haneke, because I spent the night dreaming that somebody was shouting at me in German. It lasted 6 hours, because nights are very short here. But so it's staying with me. I must mention also another sort of fascist film or to do with that period, that dark period. It's Vincere by Bellocchio on Mussolini's first wife and first son, which takes place exactly at the same time, 1910s in Italy. And I thought it was actually beautiful, and it stays with you.
A performance by Giovanna Mezzogiorno in there, an actress who I'm always quite fond of, and I think she might have a chance of the best actress here on Sunday. So that's a recommendation from Agnès there, Marco Bellocchio's Vincere. Zan, any little gems that you've picked up?
Well, I think we all get kind of fixated on the main Palme d'Or competition, but there's all these other sort of sidebars here too, and there's the general feeling that the Uncertain Regard section has been very good this year, very strong. Inevitably, I've managed to miss out on most of those, but I did see Mother by Bong Joon-ho, a South Korean filmmaker, with a fantastic lead performance by, I think, a South Korean TV actress as a mother trying to sort of prove that her son with learning disabilities is innocent of a crime that the police have railroaded him on. It's an art house film that kind of plays like a thriller, and it's utterly gripping.
Zan, you're going to stay there. We're going to talk about Francis Ford Coppola. And yes, au revoir et merci beaucoup.
Merci.
You're listening to Film Weekly from the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Jason Solomons. I'm still here with Zan Brooks. Now, we've heard about my mate Marty. Zan, you had your friend Francis. You went to meet Francis Ford Coppola. What was he doing here?
Well, Coppola isn't. He's the sort of the lost mythic beast of American cinema, isn't he? He was the great director of the 1970s who sort of fell to earth. And he was back in Cannes with a small, entirely self-funded film called Tetro, which was playing in the director's fortnight. And he sees filmmaking now as like a hobby. It's like a sort of the plaything of a retired businessman. So he's free from the studio interference. He can make exactly what he likes now. And I met up with him on a hotel terrace after a real kind of biblical rainstorm. And he told me that the film, which is about the relationship between two brothers, is at least partly autobiographical. So it's the old director looking back on where he came from.
I did this movie, which obviously has to do with some demons in my life, my family. You know, families are interesting because you love all these people and you hate them, but you love them.
Yeah.
And that makes very cloudy situations. So in a way, I feel, you know, also, when you make a film that's a more personal film, you learn something. You learn a lot. And I learned a lot about the things I was interested in. In this film also, I asked some questions in there, and since it's about my family in a way, I learned some things personally that I didn't know about myself. I didn't know that I felt abandoned by my brother. My brother was so good to me and so wonderful to me. You know, but he was 5 years older, so, you know, I wasn't competitive with him because I just wanted to be like him. But he vanished at one point from my life. I know the reasons now. But I didn't know that I felt you know, where did you go? But in writing this story, that's what it was about. And so I realized something that I'm 70 years old. I didn't know that how I took my brother's disappearance. And that was good because I feel in a way that, well, I don't have to look at that part of that again. Mm. And so I feel very much like right now as I sit talking to you that the future is a clean sheet of paper.
Actually, as we've been hearing from Francis Ford Coppola, another screening of Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds has started up in a cinema just below us, and you can hear the music, which is Ennio Morricone's music, so it's very apt there to talk about Francis Ford Coppola, Zan. What was it like to actually meet, because I love meeting Scorsese, it is a legend, someone that you've admired for so long. When you see Francis Ford Coppola, who's been here with Apocalypse Now and Conversation, what was it like to meet him?
Well, I think they're very different people, even though they're often grouped together. Scorsese is very expansive and a bit of a live wire. Meeting Coppola was like meeting the Don, where he's sort of sitting there with his kingly paunch in his armchair and kind of holding forth. But for all that, he was very friendly, very open and honest, I think. And he's a man who sort of burnt all his bridges, and he sort of doesn't really care anymore what he says.
Now, Tetro, the film that he was here actually making, starred Vincent Gallo, as you say, as a young man in Buenos Aires, visited by his younger brother. His wife's in there, played by Maribel Verdú. It's in black and white. It goes into colour. There's homages to Paul and Pressburger in there. I thought it was a bit bonkers, to be honest with you, and it rather bored me.
It didn't bore me. I agree that it's a bit bonkers. It's very operatic and over the top and expressionistic. It's like a kind of weird mix of Rumblefish, maybe, and elements of The Godfather with these kind of, you know, family sagas and hushed conversations in cafes and things like that. I liked it. It's a bit overripe, but I think that only Coppola could have made it, and it still shows that he can do it.
A good celebrity moment there from Francis Ford Coppola. I've danced with Christian Scott Thomas and Colin Firth. I've seen Peaches Geldof. I've shaken hands with Pedro Almodovar. You went to see Charlotte Gainsbourg up at the Hotel du Cap. Any celebrity moments along the way?
The Hotel du Cap is just one of the weirdest places I think I've ever been in my life. It is like kind of being dropped on another planet. So, you know, we interviewed Charlotte Gainsbourg, and then we're told to sort of wait on a bench for a cab to come and pick us up and sort of move us from this planet. And Harvey Weinstein was on the bench, so we couldn't sit on the bench. And then Harvey gets up, and a car pulls up, and Angelina Jolie steps out of it and sort of suns herself there for a spell and then wanders into the hotel. And it was just bizarre. I mean, it is just a world that we will never, ever belong to. But in Cannes, you do get little kind of glimpses of it.
That's what keeps us coming back every year. Zan Brooks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now, earlier you heard me singing the praises of Jacques Audiard's brilliant new film, Un Prophète, a superbly observed tale of young Malik caught between the prison gang culture of the Corsicans and the Arabs. Well, to find out more about this extraordinary hot film here at Cannes, I met up with director Jacques Audiard, he of Read My Lips, The Beat My Heart Skipped, and now Un Prophète. Félicitations, Jacques Audiard.
Merci beaucoup. Merci.
Your film is Un Prophète, and it's a beautiful film that continues some of the themes you were examining in The Beat My Heart Skipped and Sur Mes Lèvres. What is it about the criminal mind that fascinates you? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a sur l'esprit criminel qui vous fascine?
It's not really the criminal mind that fascinates me. It's more genre cinema that I'm interested in.
When you say genre cinema, this time it was the prison movie. Le
film de prison.
Le film de prison. Examples.
Non, mais j'en connais peu.
It's not a question of a prison film per se. I haven't seen many prison films, to be very honest, which is why I prefer to refer to film de genre, film noir, if you like. I like to highlight the side of the good and the evil.
And I think you do that beautifully. It's almost a battle for the soul of this young man.
It's a story about somebody who has no identity to start with, and in prison, paradoxically, quote-unquote, thanks to prison, he is going to find an identity.
And exactly one of the most interesting things about your film, in fact, what sets it apart from the genre, is the slightly surreal element, the magical element. How did you choose to put that in?
I loved the film Scarface, but you could say that my hero is sort of an anti-Scarface. He has
an interior life. He has an inner life. He's intelligent. He's going to make a certain path on his own. And he's not at all a psychopath. I'm not interested in psychopaths.
Where did you get this extraordinary young actor from? We'd never heard of him. Tell us about him.
Our meeting was purely by chance. I met him one day when I was coming back from the shoot that a friend was shooting, and he was in the car, in the company car. There were two actors. And I looked at him, and I knew that we would work together. The problem that was difficult afterwards was trusting my choice. I auditioned at least 40 actors afterwards just to make sure that he was the right one.
Et finalement, je vois qu'il a une moustache comme Vincent, comme Romain. Ah, c'est vrai. Hey, what is about moustaches in the work of Jacques Audiard?
Voilà, c'est la personne.
You'd have to ask my costume designer because it's not me who's chosen that. It's her. You have to ask Virginie Montel, but it's true. I don't know if there's an erotic meaning behind it or symbolism or not. You'd have to ask her.
I wonder also, Jacques, just finally to finish up, the style of your film is very distinctive. But it's European meets American style. Vous comprenez le style que vous avez. Vos influences. I want to ask on your influences and how do you then create a whole new voice.
Je sais pas comment c'est.
My influences are very, very broad. My cinephile education took place from the 1960s on to the 1980s, and yes, I love American movies and I've seen many of them. But I adore German cinema. I adore Italian cinema. I've seen many different types of cinema.
Je crois que beaucoup de mes personnages viennent du cinéma italien, en fait. Des personnages masculins, beaucoup.
I think a lot of my main male roles come from Italian cinema, were influenced by Italian cinema.
Les moustaches.
The moustaches.
Exactement. Félicitations, Jacques Audiard. Et courage pour dimanche, parce que vraiment... Finally, on Film Weekly, we turn to Jane Campion's film, Bright Star, in competition for the Palme d'Or here at the 62nd Festival. The film is a searching look at the brief but intense affair between romantic poet John Keats and his next-door muse, Fanny Brawne. Keats is played by the bright star that is young British actor Ben Whishaw. With striking performances in Perfume and the recent Brideshead Revisited under his belt, I caught up with him to find out about his latest role as the romantic poet. But first, let's hear a clip of Ben in action as Keats meeting his lover Fanny, played by Abby Cornish.
I was wondering this morning if you're sleeping in my bed.
Pardon?
You see, I believe you are. We rented Mr. Brown's half the house this summer while you were journeying in Scotland. Which room do you sleep in?
The one overlooking the back garden.
That was my bed. For proof, pull it from the wall and by the pillow you'll find a figure I drew with pinholes.
Is the figure you?
It's a fairy princess. Would you teach me poetry? I'd like to understand. I don't know how to begin.
I was told by Jane you need to become our expert on John Keats so that if anybody needs to know anything about him over the course of the shoot, you can answer the question. So I did take her at her word, and I read a mountain of books about him. I read about 5 biographies, all his letters, various kind of critical analysis of his poems. I read the poems themselves, as much as I possibly could.
Yeah.
Half of which, of course, is not useful. And it just gives you like a confidence that you know what you're talking about, and you have, you feel an ownership over what you're doing.
Yeah.
You don't feel like... There's no uncertainty or insecurity about like playing it.
And I mean, I don't mean this as any slight on your performance, but what sort of man was he? I mean, the sort of man that you portrayed, but what sort of man did you get?
The portrayal in the film is an aspect of Keats, but of course you can't distill someone down to 2 hours. And the man in the letters is much more. Well, there's a darker side to him that's not so much in evidence in the film, or we don't go into so much. He got incredibly jealous of Fanny, and very possessive. he was quite a bad lover in many respects, actually. And he had a temper, and. And he would fly into rages, you know. Yeah.
You get a lot of these, Ben. Don't you? I'm thinking about this. I was watching that. I was thinking, well, I mean, I remember you back from my brother Tom.
Yeah.
God, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then thinking of Perfume as well. Yeah. You're a dangerous bloke to fall in love with, Ben Whishaw.
Well, but the Keats that we portray is a slightly. I don't think it's. I think it's truthful to Keats, but it's an emphasis on the gentler, tenderer aspect of him.
It was a sort of lovely performance that, with it. I like the voice that you used. Was there any kind of idea? Where did you get the idea to kind of use? It's kind of your voice, a very modern kind of reading of him, almost rock star reading.
Yeah. Well, Jane encouraged us to. She didn't want the language to sound like it was antique language, you know. And so, if anything sounded to her like it belonged in a period film, you'd see her face kind of crumple, like no. Just say it. That's what she kept saying to us, you know. Just talk it like you're talking to me, which is, you know, we don't know what they sounded like, so you might as well make them sound as natural to us as possible.
You had that approach on stage in your Hamlet as well.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think, you know, what we need to just, an audience needs to feel kind of invited in to understand something, particularly when they're perhaps coming expecting not to understand it.
Well, thank you for giving us a thing of beauty. I hope it's a joy for you forever. It was a great performance, as Keats. Nice to see you. A huge thanks to Ben Whishaw there, bringing to a close this Film Weekly special from the Cannes Film Festival. Thanks to all my guests on this week's show, to Martin Scorsese, to Francis Ford Coppola, to Zan Brooks, and of course to Agnès Poirier. The music you've been hearing on this week's show was from the great Paul Pressburger film, The Red Shoes. It's the Red Shoes Suite, composed by Brian Easdale. For the best coverage of the rest of Cannes, go to guardian.co.uk/film. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons on the Quasette, and my producer who's joined me here, Jason Phipps, it's au revoir.